now we're open to discussion. You had a question before you went to Strasburg?
I did write it down.
I can't remember, I've got lots of questions. I can't remember that one.
How do you pronounce your name?
Yeah, yes.
It fascinates me because I've just finished supervising a student from Hong Kong on moral education, and the Confucius tradition was part of what he wrote about. So when you say that there's no altruism, there's no self-sacrifice in people who apply for these positions, it's really to do with money, or it's to do with positioning themselves for future. So where does the moral education that is so much of perhaps the Chinese tradition
yes.
evolve, where does that come in?
Yeah, that. And you said, China and the Chinese government and the society as well as university school has done a lot of to improve the morality of students. But that's a bad reason. Because students, the first teacher of students is mother. And sometimes students are educated by mother, and the parent said to their students, you have to be a CEO in future. You can make more money.
Yes.
So maybe the brain of students will be influenced much by the parents, and they hope that they could find a job in government. And even I met a lot of students, and they said to me, my mother told me to find a job in government, because in government, I could have a lot of guanxi relationship, and I could have a very comfortable job. I don't worry about unemployment. Because in China, the working in government is not long time. Not long. And money is high. So the family influence has been a major and a focus for
future. That's what he found, actually.
Yes.
That was what really influenced them.
Yes,
the family.
Right. Yeah.
Because, I met the Chinese people, and then some of them told me that these days, after opening up their, the marketization, the money is got in China.
Yeah.
So, I agree in part, the mother might brainwash their children, but I'm originally from South Korea. Still, Confucianism is quite strong in Korea. And compared to other countries, still, my parents' generation served their parents. And then social service is, done by family rather than social service organization. So I just want to emphasize that still Confucianist discourses and moral values is one of the dominant values, but values might be competing, like a capitalist values and Confucianist values.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say was you kept referring back to my study published from 10 years ago. We also found that there's very mixed motivation here too. I don't think we should leave you with the impression that motivation to work in the non-profit sector in Australia is totally pure and mission-driven. That's not true.
Comparatively,
compared with your findings, yes, that was much stronger. The value base was much, much stronger. And the desire to make a difference in the world, to make some sort of social change. I think that was an interesting insight too, that here we no longer expect social services to be carried out through the family. So we value those services that are provided by non-profit organisations, even more than when they're provided by the state. We found even then that there was a very strong pragmatic base as well. It wasn't the strongest, but it was strong, especially for women. The flexibility, especially around childcare, is important for women here, and still is, I think. So, and also the structural thing, it's much nicer working in small organisations that are flat. So that came across as well in ours. So there was more similarities between our findings and yours than you would suggest. But certainly, Shuangxi, which, how do you pronounce it? Shuangxi?
Rang,
Rang.
No,
Guanxi.
Guanxi. Is not strong here.
Yeah.
And value driven is very strong.
I can tell you in Thailand, if students who will graduate from university, the first point they have to think whether I or my parents could find a relationship Guanxi for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's important for me to find a job in China.
Yeah.
And in China, the competition for education, PhD, is less fierce than competition to enter into government. So if you work in government and your position will be very high. And a lot of people, maybe the workers and even the CEO in private sector will go to your office to beg you in China. Yes.
I've got two related questions. One is to do with activism and how you would define that in China, and also the relationship to the creation of these not-for-profit organisations. So if they're organisations within government departments, in a sense, then how are they initiated? Like, why is it, I'm speaking from complete ignorance about this, why is it that they exist outside of the government, although within the government?
You know
what I mean? Why isn't it just managed by the government?
I can say thank you. And I can concentrate on your second question first. In China, we have two kinds of NPO. One is bottom to top. And this kind of NPO is formed by the public, not government. But in past, a lot of organization of NPO is formed by government. And the government then trusts some function to NPO, who will be in charge of the supervising and management of enterprise. Because government needed to control the enterprise in China. It's very strange. So sometimes under the human resource, will be the person who have been working in government and then transferred to working in NPO, and there have been close, very strong close relationship between NPO and maybe a government. So we can call it quasi-government NPO. And I return to the first point is activist. Maybe now the youngest in China has maybe have a good understanding and performance. And in 2008, China Olympic Games, a lot of university students who make a lot of donation to the activist. But for the person who are maybe more than 40 or 50, because this person have influenced and undergone a very poverty in China, and they understand the economic and money is very important for them. So maybe the activist, you can find a strong wish to donate for those who are age maybe 50, 60. Because the most important thing for them to have the money to buy a house. In China, we normally even, and the house very small, and if you go to Shanghai, and even several, four or six people living in one house 10 years ago. But the situation has improved a lot.
Related to this question, but so we know there are some social movement and women's movement in China, and then that movement have organizational basis. So how they call that kind of organization, or like women's movement organization, social movement organization, environment movement organization, still take that those organizations can be classified as NPOs or any other specific
In China, somewhat NPO is only a name. Only a name in China. And for example, if I want to form an NPO, I have to get a call from the government who will be responsible for the business guidance in the industry. For example, I am working in the field of higher education. If I want to establish a formal NPO, I have to go to Shanghai Municipal Education Committee to get approval. If I can't get approval, I will not be able to make a registration on the Bureau of Community Organization. So
that limits you in getting donations.
Yes.
But it would limit you also. Would it also limit you in terms of the sort of organisation that you could set up? So it means that you can't set up an organisation that may generate dissent against a government policy.
And according to the status in 2008, there are about maybe 500,000 NPO in China who that is treated. But a large number, maybe at least 1 million, no registration, because they cannot find the organization or government to get approval. So maybe this will be the political system.
I'd like to get people to reflect back to Jenny Green's paper, and in terms of, well, actually looking back at Australia and what Jenny was telling us from China eyes, it's you know, how different are we? What did you feel about what Jenny was saying? Are we in danger of losing our soul, or are we reclaiming it?
Sorry, you were...
I've got a different question.
I was going to ask a question before you said that, now I...
Jenny. Well, please do.
It's to do with levels of organisation. So I've got an interest in activist organisation. And how it goes on from Brand's point before, how you make the distinction. You know, you talked about, I think, the difference between welfare and activist as a way of understanding different purposes and different political involvement. So I'm so curious about when organising turns into organisation, turns into not-for-profit. Like, I'm curious about that evolutionary aspect and how you might describe it.
It's a really interesting question. When I was looking at organisations, and I was looking primarily in the community services area, and there was quite a lot of activism in that. And what tended to happen was that I think that you could, you know, broadly look at the genesis of organisations in probably, you know, broadly in maybe three different ways. So there were those organisations that were well established, that had started in, you know, the late 1800s, places like the Benevolent Society, for example, that had a very strong philanthropic base that was set up by people of means to provide to those without. And then there were organisations that came out of social movements where there was, and they were activist based, where there was no provision. And they were organisations like, for example, disability organisations, where there weren't provisions for people that were in any way at all satisfactory in terms of life opportunities. And the activism there was twofold. It was sometimes by parents and sometimes it was by the people themselves, because they wanted to see their rights, in a sense.
And the purpose was to lobby government for changing policy and services?
They varied. There were ones that were about lobbying government. There were ones that were about promoting themselves and their own rights. So they were about lobbying for social change. So they were about, and I'm talking here, if you use disability as an example, they were about recognising the presence of people with disability. They were about the removal of barriers that existed that often were not even recognised within the community. There was that sort of group, and then there was another group which was primarily parent-driven, and that was very much about lobbying government for services and support. And then there were organisations that grew out of changes in terms of the social structure of our own society, and the classic ones of those were childcare and things like that, where originally the thrust around childcare was very much by single parents who were required, you know, who needed to work. But now, in fact, there's a recognition that most families with children are dual income and that childcare is a necessity. So the activism. I'll tell you where the activism changed, and that was at the point that finance was sought. That's really when
sought from the government or sought from the community as a form of donation.
Wherever it was sought. So you could see what happened was that from a group of people who got together around an issue or a cause who wanted to create change, at the point at which they really needed to develop a resource base was the point at which they became an organisation.
And then the registering also comes into play to do with tax.
That's right. That's
all
right.
Sorts of things. So that has some parallels with what you were describing, needing to register.
Yes. But in China, we have to get approval from the government organization who is responsible for business administration. And then we go to another entity called the Bureau of Community Organization. So two steps. If you can't go through the first step, you cannot get your registration.
Well, what is it like here? Is it that you have to already have a status as a community organisation in order to get the tax benefits?
So
it's a similar two-stage process, but...
There are two different ways in which it happens. You don't necessarily have to have the status in order to be able to receive a donation, but if the person who gives the donation wants to receive a tax benefit for donating, then you do need to have it. So what happens by and large is that organisations reach a threshold where they're looking for those sort of larger donations, and yes, they do need to structure themselves in order to get that tax benefit. The other thing too is that the government, both state and federal governments now, particularly with the way in which they fund organisations, require organisations in a sense to operate under the Companies Act. So a lot of the previous structures of organisations as collectives and that sort of thing has changed.
Is that part of the corporatisation, commercialisation? Yes.
And I think the change, there's been a significant change also in the sense that there are now quite a number of corporate foundations, philanthropic foundations, that are serious funders to the not-for-profit sector. And if you're going to seek that sort of funding, you need to be well and truly structured in order to do it.
And of those, would you say they're driven primarily by altruism, or would you say that the tax benefits?
Well, there are lots of different ones. There are lots of different ones, and it's quite interesting. If you look at the history of them, they developed quite differently too. So there are foundations that developed in Victoria, for example, like the Meyer Foundation. Sorry, and those ones definitely developed from an altruistic base. They were very much about looking at, you know, giving back and developing the community. The ones that have been developed more recently, they have been developed as a consequence of the sort of boom times of the 80s. They're very much about the sort of very wealthy corporates. Banks are a classic example, presenting themselves as having, social conscience. And they're very much about imaging themselves well to a community that has a tendency to see them as greedy.
Now, there has been an historical position, hasn't there, where there was the use of that position to kind of whitewash some of the activities of those organisations. But
so what do you think you mean there's a whitewash page?
Oh, you know, like, I can't think of any particular...
I can give you one.
for instance, the company that's pumping, you know, junk out into the environment that is then running, you know, green.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, Philip Morris, owns Vegemite. Oh. And Vegemite really likes, really looks for community business partnerships with children, obviously, because you know that's the way it, you know, that's the way it markets itself. A better example, I think, is if you look at something like Westpac, which has a foundation. Now, Westpac, in the 80s particularly, took a really strong position in terms of closing branches in country areas that were not profitable. And often what would happen is that when those branches were closed in really small country towns, a whole lot of other commercial activities in those towns closed as well. It had an enormously detrimental impact on communities. Yet, you know, it had its Westpac Foundation that it was, you know, setting up as, you know, its arm of, you know, corporate social responsibility, looking after the community, you know, going up to Cape York and investing in, you know, the Aboriginal communities up there. And you do have to wonder at, you know, where the two sit.
Yes.
Yeah. Very true.
A question, about going back to the individual motivations for people entering the community services sector. I mean, we've talked about like the element of it that's altruism, wanting to make a difference. What's your sense of like what shape that takes? Is it about making a difference to their service users? Is it about engaging in the political process, or both?
Sorry, just to clarify that for me again.
Just talking about people's motivations for being, personal motivations for being in the sector, not just moving into management positions. When people talk about wanting to make a difference, do you get the sense that they're talking about the everyday stuff, they're making a difference to their service users' lives, or are they engaged in the political process?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, because there were two really clearly different groups there. Those people who had come through the not-for-profit sector as a career path absolutely saw both of those as their goals. You know, they saw the individual service user and making a difference to that person, but they also saw themselves as part of a much, much larger movement. You know, a movement that was political and that was social and that was about distributive justice. It was about change. It was about a more compassionate society. The CEOs who came through the for-profit sector were exclusively focused on their own organisation, and they often talked about making a difference in terms of the service users who use their organisation.
And it ends there.
Well, it did end there, because their perception of the sector was that the sector was competitive. Uh-huh. That in fact, you know, they saw the service, you know, X number of miles away as competing with them for government contracts. So they didn't have anywhere near that same collective view of a social movement. Yeah.
Which is where it sits into the marketisation. Mm,
absolutely. Yeah, and it is one of the long-standing criticisms in the literature of that sort of neoliberal marketisation of services, you know, which basically says that instead of fostering the collaboration that used to exist between services, what it does is it pits them against each other. And the other thing it does too is it really cuts out, it funds to size for economies of scale. So what you find is that services that hit a particular threshold will do better with those funds than services that are below that threshold, because at a particular threshold you do get economies of scale around the incidental things that are not funded in individual funding packages, which is the way services are funded now. So by cutting out the smaller organisations, you immediately cut out organisations that are very, very close to their grassroots, that are embedded in a local community.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm.
But there are other organisations like,
I'm not
allowed to mention
names. Yes, don't. I'm not, but you can.
The Worldwide Doctors Service, for example,
oh, yes.
Used to operate in one way, and now it's operating in a way that it has to compete with other service providers. And so in my family, for example, a clinic was cancelled because they only had one doctor to go on the plan on a particular day. And there was this was all about money for the RFDS. Right, and you know, bugger the people who were suicidal in like Angelica or wherever. You know, the clinic was just cancelled. And it was just, it was all about funding.
Yeah.
And it was about providing a service according to the amount of money that, you know.
That's right.
And, you know, I was horrified by this because well, I thought the organisation was set up for a particular.
There's another example in Victoria. There's, and I won't mention names here, but there's a very large organisation that provided a homeless shelter. But because of the funding structure, they could only provide it Monday to Friday. So when you were homeless on the weekend, that was bad luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly the same thing. Yeah.
The other issue, I think, in terms of commitment, sorry about the monopolising question. In terms of that commitment and what motivates people to engage in the not-for-profit sector, I wonder, you know, this isn't my area of research, how much exploitation there is of that commitment.
Oh, well, that's a good point, actually.
You know, whether that's been investigated.
It has. It hasn't been investigated here so much. It hasn't really been investigated here so much in Australia in a... You know, in a particularly focused way. Although, you know, there's evidence that comes up in research that suggests that people's working conditions have really diminished, and that in relative terms, so have their salaries. But it's been investigated in the States and in a really focused way. And there's a, you know, there's a suggestion that it is absolutely exploited. That what tends to happen is that. Organisations that have these values about these humanitarian values, in fact, don't treat their workers particularly well at all.
Yep.
Yeah, that they do exploit
that. And there's
that.
This real schism in a sense where you've got this corporate structure that's being set up in this organisation. People are attracted to it because of the coming together of values. And then they're exploited in
that
organisation. They don't want to leave because they don't want to let down the clients.
Yeah.
Is there a difference within those organisations between people who do the kind of coalface work, particularly face-to-face with members of the public, and those who are in the more bureaucratic areas of the organisation, particularly as those organisations become, you know, much bigger?
Well, what... what I found was that there was a reasonable career path for people who came through from what I call, you know, field workers, you know, at that sort of initial level. There was a reasonable career path to middle management. And so at that sort of level, you're looking at people with a very similar, you know, background, who've done the same sort of work, and then what happens is the senior management level, so the position that reports to the CEO and the CEO position, that's where they're looking to import people who've come from a corporate level. And there was from the research that I did, that was where the tension existed. And what happened was a lot of the people who were in the middle management down to the sort of field officer level, there was a degree of cynicism about the organisational values and the core purpose and the implementation of that, as opposed to the chasing of the dollar, the responding to government, So, if I take that job, the job network is a very good example of this, where that was the outsourcing of the CES. People are familiar with the... Yeah. And what happened with that was that those contracts were very lucrative. They were Commonwealth for a start, whereas a lot of community service contracts are state-funded. So, by the time you get to state funding, you're already looking at a sort of reasonably poor levels of funding relative to Commonwealth. And then during the Howard years anyway, during the Liberal government, there were more and more requirements placed on organisations in terms of what they had to do with job seekers, and breaching was the real issue. And what would happen with breaching was that if a job seeker didn't engage in a certain number of job seeking activities in a week, the required number, whatever they might be, if they didn't engage in those, then they had to be reported. And as a consequence of being reported, they would have their unemployment benefits docked by a certain amount. Now, unemployment benefits sit you well and truly below the poverty line at the outset. And a lot of these people, in terms of job activities, a lot of them required people to be able to travel, to go to interviews and various things like that, which required money and those sort of things anyway. So being able to meet the number of job activities wasn't anywhere near as easy as on paper it looked as though it was. And then what would happen is a lot of the people who'd been breached, unemployment benefits were reduced, would come to, you know, organisations through a back door looking for some sort of income support or, you know, food relief packages and that sort of stuff. Now, the people who dealt with those job seekers at a face-to-face level were the field officers, the first level of management and the middle management. And they were thoroughly disillusioned. They were completely disillusioned. In general, if you look at the research on Job Network particularly, because it has been researched quite widely, what tended to happen was at the senior management level, because the contracts were so lucrative, there was enormous ambivalence about whether organisations should continue with them or not. Mm. At the field officer level and the team leader level, there was no ambivalence. They shouldn't continue with them because, you know, they were... Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions for Ran. You talked about the motivations of people in seeking employment in NPOs. Just in terms of what Jenny was saying about higher level, mm-hmm. particularly CEO level and upper management, is there a difference in do you see similar things happening in China? I mean, do people sort of make their way up the hierarchy within a private organisation and then, you know, jump over to management in an NPO, or do you tend to stay in the one? Or does everyone want to get to government?
A lot of difference in China and NPO, especially some funds and foundation and. Trade association, the CEO cannot be selected publicly. Yes. And normally, CEO will not be selected, and there are no competition. And the person will be allocated position by government.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So a government employee,
yes,
will come and fill that?
The government will send an employee who retired or who maybe have some working in the organization to work.
Mm. And what you were saying about the retirees, is it a way for government to move out?
Yes,
people?
And this will enable them to extend their working life. And because NPO somewhat will be controlled by the large SOE, state-owned enterprise, so the leader or CEO who retired from SOE would like to find a job, CEO in NGO.
I'm a bit confused about that, because if the average age was 55,
yes.
What's the retirement age?
Because some are full time, some part time.
What's the retirement age, though?
For male, 55, male, 60. And because some CEO of NBO is taken by the part time CEO in SOE and government, so the age will be a little lower than 60.
But also, it may not be someone in government may not actually be 60 and retiring,
yes,
but at 55 the government might be moving them out to,
yeah,
the NGO.
Right. In China and in Shanghai municipal government, if you form about maybe this level of 58, you cannot take the job in government, and you have to transfer yourself to another position. So maybe NPO will provide a platform for
Yes.
Job in future.
do you have the same problems, challenges, issues that we're having in Australia with corporatization of MPOs? I mean, it seems a completely different...
Yes, in China, I think if maybe the system or governance system and the relationship between MPO and government is not changed, maybe the privatization is impossible. Mm.
So is it because MPOs and governments are so intertwined that
yes.
the corporate sector is completely
yes,
different?
Yes, because Jane and Taylor, maybe there will be some field work to seek money from public. But in China, the field work of MPO find it's very difficult for them to seek money from public because the audit and the accounting of MPO is not transparent. And the person or public will not wish to give the money to MPO because they are worried about the money they have get will be used for travel and so on. So the major portion proportion of money given by a NGO is from government and membership fee. Okay.
This has been very interesting.
Really
fascinating.
Yeah,
thank you. Well, I'd really like to thank
Carmen for the time today. Thank you. Yeah. Jenny, because Jenny provides me this excellent opportunity for me to share my experience and research.
Yeah, that's fair.